Chapter 21. Lawyers Laud and Denounce Frank. In an eloquent speech, replete with word pictures, sometimes sarcastic, sometimes pathetic, sometimes humorous, but at all times dramatic, Attorney Frank A. Hooper, Thursday morning, opened the state's argument for the conviction of Leo M. Frank for the murder of Mary Fagan. He commenced days of oratory unparalleled in the history of Georgia. Mr. Hooper began his speech by declaring to the jury that the state was not seeking a verdict of guilty unless the defendant was guilty, and that the state cheerfully assumed the burden of proving him guilty. "This man," he said, pointing to Frank, "should not be convicted because the law is seeking a victim. We are not looking for blood. We are simply seeking to find and punish the murderer of little Mary Fagan." Mr. Hooper scored the conditions existing at the pencil factory, called attention to the fact that after many witnesses had sworn that Frank's character was bad, the defense had failed to interrogate them as to why they held such opinions. He described the defendant as a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, a man who was congenial with two widely different sets of associates. Mr. Hooper declared that Jim Conley had stood like Stone Mountain in the face of the terrific bombardment directed at him by Attorney Rosser in an effort to break him down. "The effort failed," said the speaker, "because Conley had, after telling many lies, eventually arrived at the truth." Perhaps the most dramatic portion of Mr. Hooper's speech was when he said, "Give the defendant the benefit of every doubt. The circumstances show that he either killed this little girl or sat there in his office and let the Negro kill her and drag her body down the hall to the elevator and take it down to the basement. This murder took place in the metal room, and it occurred while Montine Stover was in Frank's office." Mr. Hooper reminded the jury that although Frank had sworn that he did not leave his office between 12 and 1 o'clock, the Stover girl had gone there during that period and found the office empty. "I don't believe Frank had murder in his heart when he followed Mary Fagan back into the metal room," said Mr. Hooper, "but he had in his heart the lustful passions stored up for this little girl. He was killing her when Montine Stover came to the office." Hooper touched on the evidence only in a general way. He dealt more with the law. He defined the reasonable doubt, told the jury of the value of character testimony, of the worth of circumstantial evidence. Attorney Hooper occupied less time than any of the others who followed him. Attorney Arnold, who succeeded him on the floor, argued 4 hours and 40 minutes, and Luther Rosser took exactly the same time. Solicitor Dorsey talked between 11 and 12 hours, making one of the longest speeches ever made by a prosecutor in a criminal case in the South. A wonderfully persuasive and convincing speaker, Mr. Arnold was perhaps never more effective than in the Frank trial. He spoke deliberately, choosing his words, pausing for emphasis, and the gestures of a master actor could not have been more dramatic. His tall form enabling him to see and be seen from every corner of the courtroom, the peculiar resonant quality of his voice rising high above all other sounds, he caught and held the attention of spectators and jury alike with the magic of his eloquence. He started by picturing the jury as set above and apart from the public, sequestered, guarded, reading no papers, and hearing nothing of the public discussion of the trial, in order that they may impartially weigh the evidence and make up their verdict without bias or prejudice. Then, turning to address the courtroom rather than the jury, Attorney Arnold excoriated the long-tongued, loud-talking sapheads who immediately conclude that a man is guilty the moment the finger of suspicion is directed toward him. He denounced those who would punish the defendant for no other reason than that he is a Jew. He declared that if Frank had not been a Jew, he never would have been prosecuted. He paid his respects to the jury by saying they are way above the average. "I'm not saying this to flatter you," said he. "I reckon I have tried cases before 1,000 judges, and I'm telling you the simple truth. Leo Frank comes from a race of people that have made money," he said, "and that has made some people envious. I tell everybody, all within hearing of my voice, that if he hadn't been a Jew, he would never have been prosecuted. That Negro Conley has been brought into court to tell his own tale, not corroborated, but prompted. I am asking my kind of people to give this man fair play. Before I'd do a Jew an injustice, I'd want my throat cut from ear to ear. This is a case that they've built up by degrees. They've got a monstrous perjurer here by the name of Conley, and they brought a man up here who before this crime nobody had ever said a word against, and asked you to believe this Negro against him. There is always such evidence in a criminal case, and always a premonition of such evidence. After the trial was in progress 2 or 3 weeks, they got a lot of floaters, and they testified. In my criminal experience, I've seen a lot of such witnesses. I don't know whether it's imagination that makes them do it, but there is a certain class that is always ready to offer evidence. We've got a lot in this case that shouldn't be in. It's been put in to prejudice your mind against the defendant." He took up every detail of the state's theory, and with powerful logic undertook to show that this theory is unreasonable and absurd. Then, as to Conley, if he had been the solicitor and the Negro had been the defendant charged with the murder of Mary Fagan, Attorney Arnold could not have surpassed himself in trying to convince the jury of Conley's guilt. He argued that the brutal manner in which Mary Fagan was killed is characteristic of a Negro. "This man," said he of Frank, "does not come of a violent race." He argued that Conley's opportunity for killing the girl was vastly better than Frank's opportunity. His theory, constructed with consummate skill, was this: that Conley, on Saturday morning, was half drunk, his passions inflamed, crazy for money, that he lurked in the dark passageway on the first floor, at the foot of the stairs, according to his own admission, that he watched with greedy eyes every woman and girl who passed, as shown by his describing on the witness stand in minute detail the kinds of dresses and shoes worn by the girls, that Mary Fagan came down the stairs with her mesh bag in her hand, that Conley grabbed it, she refused to turn it loose and screamed, he struck her the blow over the left eye and knocked her down, and she got the blow on the back of her head as she fell, that Conley dropped her body through the elevator shaft, hung around the factory until Frank left, went down into the basement, and finished his brutal work, that then, finding the front door locked, and also being afraid to show himself on the front, broke open the back door of the basement and went his way. The law is that before a man can be convicted on circumstantial evidence, the circumstances must be so strong as to exclude every other reasonable hypothesis except that of the guilt of the accused. If Attorney Arnold himself had laid down this principle to fit his case, he could not have made it fit the case more perfectly to suit his immediate purpose of clearing Frank. His job was to convince the jury that Mary Fagan's murder can be explained just as easily, if not more easily, on the theory that Conley did it, as on the theory that Frank did it. "Suspicion," he said, "first was directed to Frank because he was the only man in the factory. He was the only man who had an opportunity to do it. Denham and White were on the fourth floor, and probably Mrs. White, too. They say they don't know anything about it, and I don't believe they do. Nobody knew anybody was down by the elevator hole, the most favorable part of the factory for a crime.
until long after Frank had been arrested. It did not crop up for weeks, but by that time the police were after Frank. First they started on Newt Lee. If he had been a weak and yielding Negro, and had seen he could get favor from the police by telling a fairy tale on Frank, the police would have thought they had put a feather in their cap. Mr. Starnes may think he is working for truth and justice, but I don't think so. It's like that decision from the Court of Appeals that I read to you this morning. Evidence gained by persecution or torture or the third degree is dangerous evidence. I don't believe Starnes or Black would write out something and say, swear to that, but they didn't have to. Conley can construct a whole story simply because they said to him, you can't swear to that, nobody will believe you. I've heard people say that Conley couldn't have thought this up. He didn't have the imagination. Everybody who has ever been around a courthouse knows that Negroes, like children, have an unlimited capacity for imagination. My friend Hooper this morning said, how did he know this much about Frank? He pointed to that word, chat. Why, everybody knows that Negroes mock their bosses and try to learn their expressions. I've seen three or four of them together trying to talk like their boss does. As that Negro lay in his cell at the police station, he conjured up the story that he has told, and it was monstrous.